This week, we have the pleasure of speaking to some of John Houser's closest friends. We will first be speaking to Andrew. Andrew was his CFI at the University of North Dakota. And then we will be speaking to his friend Dylan, who was one of John's close friends from high school. He is also a pilot and they used to row together. Between the two, I think it was incredible to be able to just kind of get more insight and more understanding of the character of John, who he was, and the impact that he had on his friends, family, and the people that he touched in his life. So, again, I can't say it enough. We are just extremely honored and obviously respect the amount of courage and compassion it goes into talking about this stuff on a public platform. As you all know, this has just been an extremely public thing from day one. So we just have a lot of admiration for these two folks. As John's CFI, can you tell us more about him and some memorable flights that you had with him? And kind of what encapsulated him as one of your students?
Well, John was my favorite student. He always showed up prepared, ready to fly, eager to fly. We never treated it as like a class or something. It was always something fun that we got to do together. One of the memorable flights that we had was we went on a cross country to Sydney, Montana. He was in his commercial course at the time, and there's a long cross country that you have to do. And we went, I think it was a Sunday. John showed up with a bag of McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, which quite a pungent smell in the cockpit of the plane all the way to Sydney, but they were quite tasty. But that flight ended up being like 5 hours, a little over 5 hours. But usually with students, after a while, you'll kind of run out of stuff to talk about. You'll hit all the small talk that you can hit. But with John, we never stopped just telling stories and talking the whole flight. There was never like a lull, it seemed, which made it go by really quickly. I remember I drank too much water before the flight, so I really had to go to the bathroom. And it didn't help that as we started getting closer to Montana, it gets a little bit bumpier, a little bit more hilly, therefore a little bit more turbulence. And so it was kind of painful every time I hit a bump that, I felt like I had to pee. And John would actually, he would apologize every time we hit a bump, but we would both laugh about it. He was trying to get us there as quickly as possible so that I wasn't in any more, pain. But once we got to Sydney, we got out. We had to stop to get some gas for the plane, and we got out and the pumps didn't work. So we sat there for a while, keep trying to get the pumps to work, and ultimately, we had to call the owner of the FBO there, and he had to drive in from town, which he said he lived 2 minutes away, just to do the same thing that we had done, and that's try every car that we had in our book. But while we were waiting for him, I got out. I was eating a sandwich that I had brought, and John went and he found there was a crew car there at the FBO. That crew car was, a really, really old. I think it was a Buick. And it was, John found the keys to it. They're in the car. He turned it on and it was maybe the loudest car I've ever heard. John rolled down the windows and he drives it out onto the ramp and just kind of starts driving in circles. It's a really loud car with this huge smile on his face. He asked if I wanted to drive it, and I declined just so I could eat my sandwich, but I regret not doing so. But on the way back, the same thing. We just talked the whole time and just kind of chatted. And I remember when we were maybe like 20 miles away from Grand Forks, he looked at me and said that that was the most fun flight he'd ever been on, which that was pretty nice to hear. But let's see, another flight that we had, I think it was the last flight we actually had together, was a night flight. We had a night dual flight where I think he was just getting night current. So we only had to do 3 takeoffs and landings, but he wanted to do more. And he actually wanted to create sort of like a competition out of it to see who could land better at night. And one of the news stories about John, there's actually this video of a night landing. And funny enough, that's my landing that he recorded as we kept doing these patterns together and trying to see who could land better. And unfortunately for me, he did beat me in that competition. Awesome. Made me feel bad that my student, you know, landed better than I, but that's just how John was as a pilot.
Yeah, he definitely was, as his mom had said, very mature individual and very studious and confident in his flight skills. And you guys had said that you had many conversations when you were flying together. So did you ever have a conversation with John about mental fitness, or did he ever mention anything related to mental health with you?
Honestly, I can't recall ever having a conversation about that. I don't think, I mean, a couple times we had like talked about, you know, aircraft accidents, but it was more like we were interested in like the results of the accidents.
Yeah.
But we never, I don't think we ever really touched on mental health.
So, now obviously this is like a big topic of conversation in the aviation space, but is that something now that you are uniquely aware of because of John? And did that change the way that you instruct in any way?
Yeah. So, honestly, I had no idea that it was such an issue, in aviation until, you know, John kind of, I guess, made that apparent. But, you know, it's let me see that there is a huge issue with it. He's not the first person to do this, and nor will he probably be the last, because unfortunately, there's still not a whole lot of change happening. But when it comes to instructing students, I always tried to treat students as they were, you know, people and friends, more than just, you know, a student. And John, you know, it kind of shows that, you know, you need to treat everybody with respect, because you have no idea what's going on, you know, outside of flying. But immediately following the accident, I met with my students, and, you know, I made sure that they felt okay. And then I asked them if they had anything going on, because I was pretty much blindsided by this. You know, I couldn't tell that John had anything going on. And I don't know if the others have talked about this, but he hid it really well. But it just goes to show how somebody can be holding something in without, you know, showing any signs. So as an instructor, you just have to kind of take that into account and make sure that you're, you know, trying to look for small signals and, you know, just treating people with respect.
Yeah, I find that most of the people that we've talked to have suffered a loss that is similar to John's, like where obviously they've committed suicide, that most of the people never see that in their loved one. Like that they are very good at hiding things. So that becomes the really hard thing, is like, when will we know when we see it, and will we see it, you know? And I think oftentimes we don't see the signs because they're so good at hiding them, especially pilots.
Right.
Yeah. So if you don't mind me asking, how has John's passing affected you? I can't imagine, it's been incredibly hard, but if you could give us some insight.
Yeah. Well, initially, you know, like I said, it was a big shock. It almost motivated me to try to push for change. Immediately following the accident, I met with the dean of our school and the director of safety to try to come up with some ideas that, you know, we can prevent this in the future. but it really just, I mean, it's tough. It makes you, I've never really had a family member or anybody close to me until that point, you know, pass away. So it's kind of, you know, the grief and emotions that I went through were, you know, the first time that I've ever had to experience something like that. And it's not easy, but the way I kind of push myself through it is thinking about how, if we could get anything out of it, if we could have, you know, the accident or, you know, be a catalyst for change when it comes to mental health and system reform. So.
I really think like that it has been a huge story in the aviation space. Everything that I go to that has to do with mental health and aviation, John's story is always shared. And obviously he's been a huge catalyst, which is something that we're grateful for, because we know that John wants change in the air medical space. But if you had your own ideas of change or reform in the air medical system, like what would you change?
Well, you know, it's kind of difficult because it's not only the FA that was, you know, an issue, but I think it was a little bit of the school as well, creating some stress for John and ultimately pushed it over the edge. But, you know, I think the big problem is that there's people that are just scared to admit that they have issues. People aren't comfortable enough to go and get help because of the fear that they're going to lose a medical. You know, he's actually not the first person that I know. My stepdad's friend, he was a pilot for Southwest, and he too committed suicide due to mental health issues. And it's, you know, the big word is just comfortability. People just aren't quite comfortable enough to come forward and get help without, you know, the fear of repercussions. And it's hard to really narrow down exactly what could be done, but I have two other students that haven't flown. I had them as students last spring, and they haven't flown for well over 6 months because they're waiting on getting another special issuance medical. They had one already, and they it expired, or they had to check in with a psychologist, and their psychologists are out of town. One of them is, you know, up in Alaska, the other one in Illinois, and it's,
jeez,
you know, it's hard for people to like to make it work. You know, if they do come forward that they have issues, it just, you know, I just wish there was an easier way. I've been asked this question a lot, is what would I change? But really, I think if there was just an easier way for people to come forward and less repercussions for it, then I think a lot more people would do it and a lot more people would want to seek help.
Yeah. I think it's hard too. And not a lot of people understand that 6, 12 months, 24 months for somebody in this profession, especially as a student pilot, that's a lot of time. You know, right now you can go if you want and apply and dedicate yourself really hard and be able to get two ratings in 6 months. You know what I mean? So for people to be held up like this, and I can imagine the pressures of watching your classmates and other students be able to progress, and you're waiting on something that you really don't know if you're going to get an answer to, can feel extremely, I don't know, that's just an awful thing to have to go through.
Right. Yeah.
I do have one more question for you, because you had mentioned like it's not only the FAA, but also that John was feeling pressure from UND. So can you kind of expand on that?
Yeah. So, you know, UND, well, at the time there was, they were training, or they were changing TCOs with a training course outline. They're basically changing the structure of the courses here at UND. There used to be 3 certificates all packed into one. That was your instrument, commercial, and multi-engine, all packed into one, basically, one check ride, essentially. the FA came and said that we have to now separate those. So now the courses are separate. There's instrument, commercial, and multi-engine. And what that did is that gave students who were basically in that initial course a timeline that they had to be finished by, I can't remember the date, but X date. And if they weren't finished by then they would have to go back and do all of the check rides again for the instrument, commercial, multi-engine separately, the ones that they've already done. And at the time, John was in his commercial course. So he'd done instrument, he was in commercial, but he had to finish commercial and multi-engine. And he was kind of on a tight schedule.
Wow. And then what you said about those check rides, that's very eye-opening. And I mean, I know most of our listeners out there, most of y'all have taken a check ride. I can't imagine. I mean, I hate a check ride. It's part of the reason why I'm like, you know, do I really want my commercial rating right now? I really don't want to have to take another check ride. I just absolutely hate them. And there are people out there that suffer with severe anxiety, testing anxiety. So to have to go through that all at once. And then, like you were saying, if you fail one, then you're going to have to go back and retake all of them. That is just bonkers. And I'm assuming that for these, is this something, if you don't mind me asking, are you paying? I know for me, I'm a part 161 student. I have to pay out of pocket for, you know, check rides. And if I fail, I'm having to pay again. Are you having to pay out of pocket for these check rides if you have to go back and do them?
Yeah. So, basically if you didn't finish before that deadline, if you didn't get that final rating, which is the multi-engine, then you would have had to go back and redo every check ride. And yes, you'd have to pay for them as well.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So that is just, holy crap. I'm like, I kind of got goosebumps because I just cannot imagine the amount of pressure.
It's right. Like a money grab too. I'm like, what do these colleges want? Like, they've already proved that they can do it. So now they're going to make you do it again and pay more money. It seems backwards.
Yeah. You know, it's, you know, you can kind of look at a school like this and just kind of see it as a business, and yeah. Students are just customers instead of students. And it's, you know,
wow. That's extremely eye-opening, Andrew. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And it does kind of, you know, when you start to look at things like this, you can understand the gravity of the situation. I thought it was also pretty eye-opening what you had mentioned about the school kind of being silent as far as mental health prior to John's accident. And I know you had just mentioned the one CFI who had taken his own life. And then I believe everyone knows that like 10 years ago, there was also, it was a student or a CFI that had taken their own life. So it's just incredible to me that it's taken this long for this school to realize that they have to prioritize this.
Right. Yeah. 10 years ago, I think it was a CFI that took his own life. Mm-hmm. And he had gotten in trouble. Story that I had heard, he got in trouble with a DUI and basically saw no recovery from that.
Yeah. That is extremely tragic and unfortunate. And yeah, and just going back on the conversation we had, you can only put yourself in a person's shoes like that and think, like, what other option do you have? It's just such a fundamental part of your life. College and your 20s are, I would say, you know, one of the hardest parts of your life. You're really learning how to be an adult. You're coming into your own, and things like this can feel extremely life ending and life changing for a certain individual.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, if something like that happens, it just kind of, you know, changes your course, and not for a better way.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time and having the courage to be able to sit down and talk to us today. We just extend our condolences. I know it's, you know, I think we're past a year at this point, but as we all know on this podcast, we talk about a lot. Grief is an ever-changing road, and we have sympathy for you and everyone who's been affected by this.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. John, I know his passing, his main goal essentially was that there would be change and reform. So I'm happy to hear that at least people are trying to, you know, make some change.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you again, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you guys.
So Dylan, how did you come to know John? And what is your first memory you have of meeting him, and how did your friendship form?
So I first knew John. I don't remember exactly like when I first saw him or anything, but we were both on our high school rowing team together, Chicago Rowing Foundation. We were both there from freshman to senior year. And so he was on my novice team. And so I remember rowing a boat with him then. And I have some funny memories with him, but our friendship really started to form kind of junior year. I feel like when junior and senior year, we were both in the top boat at our program. And rowing is a very team-oriented sport. And so it kind of allows and also kind of forces you to become really close with everyone that's in the boat with you. And so that was kind of my path knowing John. But then more specifically also on the aviation side, and aviation is kind of what brought us together closer than we would have been otherwise. I kind of just overheard him talking about a flight lesson during a practice at one point. And I had no idea that he was a pilot. I was also currently training for my private pilot lessons. And I just overheard him talking about, I think it was a simulated engine out that his CFI had given him that day. And then from there, every time we saw each other, it'd just be constant aviation talk. It was the rowing team and then also the connection of aviation there.
I feel like that is typically like once you start talking about aviation, if anyone else is involved in aviation, they like gravitate towards each other. So mm-hmm. It's very easy to understand how you guys became friends. And I wanted to know if you were ever able to fly with John, what was it like to fly with him?
So we flew together a handful of times. The first time was actually right after he had gotten his license. And I had not quite gotten my license yet because he kind of fast-tracked it so he could get it before he went to UND. And so it was fun because it was right after his check ride, not right after, but, you know, within a month of his check ride. And we went up together and he was telling me about all the things that his check pilot had asked him and, you know, where he had struggled. And so that was super interesting for me, you know, just a few months away from my own check ride. So I flew with him that time. And then we flew up and down the Chicago lakefront a few times. And then we also did other various trips together. But it was awesome flying with him. He was definitely a really great pilot. The one thing that I always kind of still to this day try and emulate of his practices is that he really knew how to shift focus when it came to kind of any sort of safety measure, any sort of safety of the flight issue. Because I just remember on our flight, we were all joking on the way to the airport and, you know, prepping for the flight a little bit, looking at the weather and whatnot. And then once we got there, he got very serious doing the pre-flight, making sure everything's okay. And then we got on the plane. It was fun to be in the plane with him because you could tell he knew exactly what he was doing. It was very passionate about flying.
It's nice when you get to fly with somebody who is just, I don't know, there's a level of responsibility you can tell some people have for it. And it doesn't matter if you're a private pilot or a CFI or an airline pilot, there are just some people who have this incredible switch of being able to, it's like the minute they step foot on that tarmac, it's like a whole new mindset. And to watch people get in that zone and get really serious is a true skill set. And it does make flying with someone like that all the more fun because you know that this person is in control and they're confident in their abilities.
Absolutely.
So do you know, or did you know that John was struggling with his mental health? Had he ever brought that up to you?
No, not at all. And to the best of my knowledge, none of, you know, our group of friends knew either. To the point that on the night that he passed away, he sent out a couple texts, and another one of our friends reached out to me worried about it and called me and was like, do you think he's okay? And it wasn't even in the realm of possible outcomes in my head that he wasn't okay. And I, you know, just reassured them, like, oh yeah, I'm sure he's fine. You know, maybe he's just at a party or something, or, you know, whatever. But
yeah, it seems to be a lot of the people that we've spoken to about him. It seems like it was just a shock all around, that he seemed like just like a joy, like his life was full of joy and happiness, and he was extremely happy where he was at. And within talking to other peers who have lost husbands or spouses who were airline pilots or whatever phase of training they were in, it seems to be this common theme of this is the last person you would have ever guessed.
So with that, like after John's passing, what kind of was the grieving process for you? Like, what did that look like? Because you had lost John in such a public way. What did that look like for you?
It was a lot of reliance on my friends and family, the kind of routine that I had set up before that. The group of us that all rode together, we tried to stay in pretty tight communication, especially immediately following that. We all kind of agreed, we thought the best path forward was to try and keep doing what we were doing day to day. There a bunch of us row in college, and so we were trying to just keep going to practice, keep, you know, getting classes done. It stayed like that until the funeral was planned for, I think, 2 or 3 weeks afterwards. And we all came back, and we all kind of collectively started grieving together when we saw each other in person.
I was gonna ask you too, because Anne had mentioned that y'all had started a thing for John at the rowing place that you row at, that was like joy and honor, I think, or not joy and honor, but his joy initials, and hope. Joy and hope. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Joy and hope is his initials and all that. Very unfortunately, and I think this also played into John's mental state, but we lost another friend in my junior year of high school, and we had set up a really awesome foundation, a really awesome fund in his name, and you know, the club is going to get boats for the next, you know, like whatever 20 or 30 years from that fund.
I can only imagine this, like what you said about you and your friends coming together for his funeral, and how that kind of started that grieving process together. So it's, from what I'm understanding it, most of y'all were in your first or second year of college when this happened, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And because of COVID, some of us hadn't actually been at college at all yet in person. And so a bunch of us were in our first semester actually on campus as well.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I just think about myself and what it's like when you kind of come back into town and you're meeting up with all your old, like your high school group. I can only imagine that had to be hard to meet up in that way. But the fact that y'all were all able to come together and kind of start that together, I can only imagine did give you a level of comfort.
Absolutely. Yeah. That it's, especially at a time like that, it's super relieving to see friends and friendly faces.
I can only imagine. So Dylan, if a pilot were to, you know, come up to you in person or come into your DMs and was seeking advice for their mental health or saying that they would like to go seek help, what would you tell them?
Well, I think first and foremost, I would say thank you to them for coming to me. I know it's definitely not easy to come forward with that type of thing to anyone, even if I am their close friend, and especially from a pilot. I think really the only thing to say is just that for their own benefit, but also for their friends and their family's sake, like they need to get help and they need to do whatever they need to do so that they, you know, deal with whatever they're going through. You know, life is hard and it's not always possible to get through it by yourself. And so, you know, there's certainly a risk around it with aviation, in terms of, you know, it's a position that no one should ever be in, to have to decide between their career and their mental health. And I really hope that as time goes on, that changes and there isn't so much stigmatism around it. But I would say they have to do whatever they have to do to resolve the current situation they're in. And another point that I would make is that just, I think it should be talked about, especially in aviation, more. Because, like, you know, through all my flight training and everything, very seldomly was anything said about mental health. You know, there was a few comments about, you know, with I'm Safe, talking about making sure you're emotionally stable. But, you know, it's a small part of a small section of your initial flight training. And I think it's a little scary to me that as a pilot, I don't know how to handle a pilot coming to me any better than I think anyone would.
I like that you pointed that out. I've always said on the podcast, I'm like, you know, that those checklists that we do, the I'm Safe, this, that, and the other, it's like, you know, I've always, the biggest beef I've had is the E for external pressures. And I, out of just curiosity, I started making a game of asking every single flight instructor, what does that mean? Like, what do you think that means? And what does it mean for you? And I feel like I need to start a new petition to like turn that E into external pressures, is having an entire conversation about mental health, because we really don't. It's like we hit every other facet we're hitting. We're making sure, oh, you're not sick. There's no fluid in your ears. Like, God forbid you fly with a sinus infection, but nobody ever talks about, you know, how you're doing, and how you feel mentally and what mental fitness is. We talk about flight fitness all the time. We don't talk about mental fitness.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dylan.
Yeah, I was just saying, talking about mental fitness, and then also just talking about the, whatever the current legislation is, or the current FAA rules are on, mental health and seeing a therapist and all that, because I think a lot of it is just taken from stigma and kind of like hearsay from whatever anyone is saying about what they think the rules are. And I think it is not, there isn't enough transparency there.
Definitely. I think we can all agree on that, that it's just like the FAA and their standards always seem so convoluted. They'll say one thing, but then, you know, the fine print says something different. So it's definitely important to know those things. And the other thing I wanted to note on Emma talking about external pressures is like, those are kind of the things that we sift out about the people after they've passed away. Like what triggered them to go and do this? And those are the external pressures that they're facing usually is what has brought them to the point that they're at. So definitely important to pay attention to. Amen. But I did want to just end with you giving us a look into one of your favorite memories with John.
There are definitely a lot to choose from. We've had a lot of great various road trips and whatnot, but kind of one aviation related one was August of 2021. So just a few months before he passed. I had just gotten my license at the beginning of that summer. And so we had been flying a little bit over the summer together. And then we wanted to take our other friend, Colin Black, up on a flight. And we decided just to go for $100 burger over in the small airport called Rochelle. That's just a little bit east of Chicago or west of Chicago. And I just remember kind of like we were talking about at the very beginning, but just it was really fun to see that the flip switch. He wasn't PIC because he'd been flying mostly Pipers and I was the one current in 172, but even though he was not the pilot flying the whole time, he was constantly, he had his iPad up, he had his Sentry ready, he was watching the ADS-B, we were talking about the different airspaces we were flying through them. And I just remember being in the plane, just kind of being in awe of how much he had learned in 1 year at UND, but also just how passionate he was about flying. So that's definitely one of my favorite memories with him.
If you wanted to, you can tell us one more that's like outside of aviation as well, because we really try to like humanize pilots and show that like you guys are more than pilots. So if you wanted to share one more with John that's like outside of aviation, sure. We would love to hear it.
Another. Yeah. There's a race that the rowing team always goes to in the fall called Head of the Hooch. And my senior year, we were pretty happy with how our boat was doing and we had a pretty strong boat. John was sitting 2-seat and I was sitting 6-seat. And so we went to this race every year, and previously the best we'd ever done was 11th place at Head of the Hooch. We were going in and we wanted to just beat that 11th place, you know, record for the club. And so we start the race and it's feeling really good and we're cruising along. We start catching up to the boat in front of us. This race is a head race style. So it's a boat is launched every 30 seconds. And so we start 30 seconds behind the boat in front of us, but by the end of the like 20 minute race, we start catching them. And we're about to pass them. And I remember we were all pretty tired at that point, right? All huffing and puffing, just wanting the race to end. And John just screamed out of bow. Honestly, I don't even remember what he said, but he just let out some scream out of bow and encouraged all the guys. Yeah, that's what got us through the finish of that race. And that's kind of who John was on the team, was that he would kind of be the backboard that would support a lot of us through whatever piece or race or whatever we were going through.
It makes me smile, like listening to these stories and talking to Anne and talking to Andrew, and it seems like Anne emphasized that he had like a very strong like personality and he was like very outspoken and loud.
Absolutely.
And I can relate to that because I feel like loud and outspoken and it's just that's the common theme I'm getting from everyone, is just this kid was a light for so many people and just a brightness for and touched so many people's lives. I mean, he's touched my life. I never even knew him, but he's touched my life. I know he's touched Maddie's life, and we're just beyond grateful to be able to sit down and have this conversation with you today.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for having this conversation. And just for talking about this issue in general. As I said before, I really, really appreciate that you guys are doing this.
Yeah. Thank you again, Dylan.